Hello and welcome to this Sustainable Wine Podcast. This is a recording of a conference session that took place on the 2nd or 3rd of June 2021 as part of Sustainable Wine's Future of Wine Americas Conference 2021. We'd very much like to thank the sponsors of that conference, BSI, Bodega Argento, Jackson Family Wines, International Wineries for Climate Action, and Avenea. Thank you to all of those groups for their important support, and I hope you enjoy the session. This is our second conference session. The first one was around the broader theme of leadership, and we had some fascinating insights there on what that's looks like now and how it's accelerating, particularly with issues around climate change, fires, COVID, and so on, which has really accelerated sustainability thinking. If there is any silver lining of COVID, it's perhaps made us all a bit more thoughtful about our futures and what we can do to secure them. So in this session, we're going to talk about climate strategy, a huge issue, obviously, in the wine world and elsewhere. As an industry, the wine industry doesn't have an enormous climate footprint compared to all the others. But as discussed in the previous session, it has this incredible ability to communicate with so many people in the world who love wine. And that's such a powerful message. And that's why the work of IWCA and others is so powerful in reaching those not directly in the industry, but also outside it to help them understand what climate change means for the sector. So delighted that we have four great panelists for this. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves now very briefly and then make some opening comments on the subject of how we develop a credible climate strategy. So starting in order of the agenda, Jessica, give us the 30 seconds on yourself and FETSA.
Sure. Hi, everyone. It's so good to be here. My name is Jess Baum, and I'm the Director of Regenerative Development and Sustainability at FETSA Vineyards. I am new to the wine industry, having spent most of my career in the personal care industry and also some time in the restaurant industry. And so I bring kind of a both outside and inside wine perspective on this. And I'm just excited to talk about this today. I really believe that you can't manage what you don't measure, and that getting started on that journey or continuing on that journey is really important.
Thanks, Jess. Will.
Morning, everyone, and thanks for having us, Toby. My name's Will, and I work for Treasury Wine Estates. Treasury is a large global company with vineyards and wineries in Australia, New Zealand, Europe, and here in the Americas. And my background is really one of science and kind of across a broad stroke of different disciplines, and from psychology to plant science, and a little bit of everything in between. So I think that's kind of helpful in the way we tackle sustainability, because it's such a multifaceted problem and you need to really be a jack of all trades in order to tackle it. So that's it.
Thanks, Will. Welcome, Julian.
Yes, good morning. My name is Julian Givro. I'm the Vice President of Sustainability for Jackson Family Wines in California. And I'm also a founding board member of IWCA. So I'm really here, I think, to speak more on behalf of IWCA today. For those of you who did hear the earlier panel, you heard Katie talk a lot about some of the previous work that Jackson Family has engaged in over the last decade to measure and reduce our impacts on water, energy, greenhouse gas emissions. We do have an announcement that we're going to be making focusing on the next decade a little bit later this summer. And I think Beth Milliken on the earlier panel really underscored the importance of this next decade as it relates to action. We're in a position where we have to move. We have to move quickly. We have to move decisively. And I think we have to move collectively as an industry. A little bit more about my background. I'm a wine industry lifer. I grew up in the industry. Took a break in around 2010 to go back to graduate school. I got my MBA in sustainable management from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, which is a focused program that really is completely focused on aligning business and sustainability. We talked a lot about making what we call the business case for sustainability. I had every intention of getting out of the wine industry when I went to Presidio, and within about a semester, I recognized that everything that I was learning at Presidio tied directly back to the wine industry. So I kind of redoubled my resolve and my recognition that we are in this amazing industry that has such a great connection to the land, to the consumer, and to the global community. And I've been fortunate enough to be with Jackson Family Wines for the last 8 odd years, and excited to be on the panel.
Thanks, Julian. I'm glad you made the right decision. Lots of people working in other industries, and the wine industry needs all the sustainability expertise it can get. Diana,
more than wine.
Diana, welcome back. Nice to see you again. You came to our conference in November. Nice to see you virtually again. Tell us a bit about yourself and Jujak and Snowden.
Okay, thank you very much. Nice to be here. Diana Snowden Sess. I'm a winemaker. I am a Napa native, and Snowden Vineyards was. The vineyards were purchased by my grandparents. I'm the first person in my family to work in wine. And I am talking to you today from Burgundy, where I commute back to Napa to make my family's wines, but I live and work here with my husband's winery and called Domaine Dujac. And we also have a third winery in Provence called Trienne, which is co-owned by a few partners. But that perspective of having three different sizes in California, about 25,000 bottles, Dujac is about 100,000 bottles, and then Domaine de Trienne is about 1 million bottles, means that what you can do in terms of reducing emissions is a bit different depending on your size. So it's been very interesting to look at how I can be powerful, how we can be powerful as an industry from the lens of those three very different perspectives.
Thanks very much. Well, let's stay with you for now, Diana. What does this idea of a credible climate strategy looks like? It's a big word, isn't it? But what does that actually mean for where you work?
I think that for one thing, and I think that you're really getting at it here right now, we absolutely have to stop being sloppy with the word sustainability. It's a very important concept, and we have been abusing it and considering that whatever we do could last maybe 10 years, 30 years, when actually here I am in Burgundy, where grapes have been grown for 2,000 years, and you have to approach both farm work and your greater commercial work from a standpoint of how can we maintain this in those next generations. And we have exploited resources, and we have released carbon dioxide to a point where we won't be able to pass on these beautiful businesses to the next generation unless we really change the way we operate. So, you know, if we're talking just about carbon today, that's one thing, and keeping an eye on your emissions and again how you can reduce them or even make them negative. There are a lot of exciting new technologies that are becoming more and more accessible. That's one thing. And another thing is also keeping an eye on the health of your soils, which is, so there's some overlap with carbon absorption. And then there's really also some things that you can do to damage and kill soil. So keeping, you know, if you just focus on carbon emissions, you could make some really dangerous decisions for soil health. So I think from my perspective, it's important to have a holistic eye on the choices you make, both in the vineyard and as a company.
Thanks. And what do you call it where you do it? In the sense that regenerative ag is everywhere now, but this spawned this huge argument. There are some people who say to me, "Oh, it's for kind of the ROC and the regenerative organic certification, the Rodale Institute." Other people say regenerative is being stolen by big ag, where General Mills wants to certify 1 million hectares. But it does seem to be a term that gets people excited, particularly in smaller producers. And I wondered what sort of terminology in the languages that you use that makes sense to those around you.
So I should not say we still till both at all of the companies. We still till. On the other hand, we have been not used herbicides at any of the companies for decades. And I think that probably the best way to get at the problem would to start measuring the carbon dioxide absorption capacity of soils. I think that's probably the best approach, because I have only started with some trials of no-till, and I'm not completely convinced that that's the best strategy, especially in a circumstance where we have less and less water. So I before I would go all the way to no-till, I would want to start having some standards for carbon dioxide absorption capacity of soils with regards to farming practices, like with or without herbicides, with or without weeds or cover crop.
I did see, I think it was Chateau Montrose, who have been capturing carbon from fermentation. I spoke to the CEO, Hervé Bellon, recently. And I think now they just announced that they've got a trial of doing exactly that, of measuring soil carbon capture from their vineyards. And that's just...
Oh, yeah. It's happening everywhere. It's happening in California as well. I mean, Napa Green, we're delighted to have it. They're connecting us with Nori, which is a carbon sales group, and we'll start establishing our carbon absorbing capacity of our soils and selling that as offsets. And that is at least, a lot of these ecological choices are expensive. And so for farmers, that actually means allowing us to farm in a way that also puts carbon in the soil.
Yeah, that seems absolutely vital. Thank you. We'll come back to many of those points, I'm sure. Let me turn to you, Jess, from a FETSA point of view. And by the way, if you can tune into our first panel tomorrow morning, it'd be great to hear your views on that, because that's a group of people from outside the wine industry who know sustainability. So it'd be great to have you commenting and involved in that session as well. But be interested to hear your view, Jess, on this. And I mean, regenerative is really what FETSA's gone big with. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do want to take a moment to introduce FETSA Vineyards, because in my brief introduction, I only really spoke about my background. And FETSA Vineyards has been around for 52 years, and we've been engaged in regenerative agriculture for 30 plus of those years. And we farm 100% organic, but we really feel like we go beyond organic and beyond sustainable, trying to leverage the power of natural technologies to sequester carbon and increase fertility of the land and biodiversity within the ecosystem through all that we do. And we've been doing that for a long time. So regenerative is definitely something, a word that we, you know, it's part of my title, and it's a very important part of what we do, because we know that if we were to sustain the systems the way that they are, we're headed for disaster. And wine is at the front lines of climate change. And that's part of why I got involved in this industry. One, because we are at the front lines of climate change, and we are seeing the effects in a much more sensitive way than other industries. And also because we're a single agricultural input industry. So we can go a lot farther, faster in the field of regenerative agriculture, because we're not looking after 100 different crops that we're sourcing from around the world. We're looking after one crop that we're sourcing from limited regions, usually local to where our operations are. And so there's a lot more that we can do there. And we know that the world is in crisis right now, which is why we declared a climate emergency last year and made a commitment to be climate positive by 2030. And in the coming months, we'll be announcing some really exciting developments and progress in that arena for FETSA Vineyards. And I also want to say that I think it's important to note that size of a company doesn't really matter in this journey. It might change the strategy. It might change the way that you engage. For instance, we aren't all Amazon, so we can't all affect, you know, the shipping system, the paradigm. And we can't all say, you know, we're only going to ship things in electrified vehicles, because we don't necessarily have that buying power. But all of us, what we can do is the fullest scope 3 emission assessment that we possibly can. And we can look at where our impact lies and strategically decide where can we have the most impact. And maybe that's in the largest area of greenhouse gas emissions. Maybe it's not in the largest area. Maybe it's in the easiest to move, because we know that we're in crisis and we have to move as fast and as far as we possibly can. So maybe it's looking at scope 2 emissions and going, renewable on site. We put solar panels on our vineyard in 1999, and we currently use 100% renewable energy, but we know that our biggest footprint lies elsewhere. However, I think it's really important to move the needle where you can, when you can.
Thanks. So just to clarify, your climate strategy is done through the lens of regenerative approaches. Is that right?
Absolutely. And it's done through that lens because we believe in this idea of not just sustaining, but leaving things better than we found it. And so we call it climate positive. Other people call it carbon negative, but really inherent in our strategy. And I think inherent really in any agricultural industry strategy should be carbon sequestration, and not just, I think it's really dangerous to look just at the carbon piece of that because it's very nuanced. You have to also obviously look at ecosystem health. To Diana's point, you know, no-till doesn't necessarily work in our industry. It's not necessarily what's best for the ecosystem. So we use a very low-till method where we're tilling a lot less than industry averages. And we feel like that's the best thing for the ecosystem. And really also with our biodynamic approach, we're looking not just at the health of the vines, we're looking at the health of the vineyard as an organism as a whole. And so, yes, we take a regenerative approach in that we measure our footprint and then we reduce it wherever possible. And then ideally we're insetting insetting on farm or elsewhere, our carbon footprint that we can't necessarily shrink, like for instance, from our shipping, which we're working towards, but we're not an Amazon. We don't have the buying power to say, UPS, we won't work with you unless you 100% electrify your shipping. So that's where advocacy comes in and becomes a really critical piece of our strategy and collaborating with others to push for systemic change.
Thank you. And on the tilling thing, that's very interesting because it's not a monolithic entity, is it? I mean, there's tilling and then there's tilling. So will you then be measuring the impact of that and the sort of reporting out on what different degrees of tilling actually do for soil oxidation or, you know, GHG emissions?
Yeah, we do track, we track our tillage and we track our, total organic carbon in the soil over time. And we have different ways that we're tracking the impact of our farming methodologies in the soil. And some of those are quantitative, some of those are scientific, and some of those are more a farming art. We have an amazing vineyard team who looks at things like, how does the soil feel? How does it smell? What does it look like? How does it crumble between our fingers? And I think those pieces, you have to look at it part art, part science. You can't break it apart because it's a living, breathing thing, and it's so much more complex. So yes, we're looking at all of those things. We've done a soil study that looks at how we're working with our soils, and we continue that work. But we're not necessarily, we've kind of found the way that works for us, which is minimal tillage, and we're not comparing it to maximum tillage because that's not something we're doing and not something we've done.
Okay, thank you. Will, what does all this look like to you? I mean, Treasury's a big company for the wine industry. What is your board asking you for on this? Are they saying, give us a climate strategy? Are they saying regenerative? Are they confused by the terminology? I mean, what's the situation?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of stakeholders in sustainability, right? So it's not just our board. But a board is obviously paying attention to the investors in Treasury Wine Estates. And all of those folks are paying attention to our customers and our consumers, who's buying our wine and why they're buying it, how we have access to markets. And then, you know, closest to home is probably our community and our families that all live and around the wine industry, having demands on us and how we should be acting. And our employees, you know, they're the biggest drivers and advocates for what we can do. So, to say it would be the board driving it, they absolutely have a hefty say in it, but it's definitely multifaceted. So how do you sort all of that out? Because you have a lot of different stakeholders there. You need to try and figure out what's important, what's not, what's right for Treasury Wine Estates. And Treasury Wine Estates is not a monolith. You know, we're made up of a lot of small luxury brands all over the world doing different things to different people for different reasons. So, you know, we wanted to sort all of that out from what was most important to us to maybe least important to us. And it's not saying it's not less important. It's just that nobody has all the funds and the people and the time to focus on everything that they would like to do, right? So you really do have to prioritize things. So we went through a process of asking internal stakeholders, you know, what they thought. And that's the board, that's our executive leadership team, that's key people throughout the business in different areas of winemaking and vineyards. And packaging and things, as well as external stakeholders from universities and think tanks and customers, you know, people who sell our wines in the Nordics and all across. And we kind of filtered those into areas that we thought were most important and least important. And that at least gave us a kind of a North Star about these are the things that should be tackling first. And it was great to see the sort of more obvious things float to the top. Around carbon and around water, two critical aspects for our industry. But I'd hate to kind of gloss over it with any one particular catchphrase. And I think regenerative is a fantastic term. Sustainability is a fantastic term. And they're all in danger of being kind of worn thin if we overuse them or use them too expansively. We kind of get the impression that people know what we're talking about when we're talking about those terms. But it is important to get to the details about what you mean. And that's part of what I think a credible climate strategy is. It's not just a sort of a motherhood statement around, you know, we want to do better for the planet and we want to look after our land. And of course, we want to do those things. But I think being public about what you're doing, you know, everyone on this call has done fantastic efforts and ahead of what we've been doing in terms of talking publicly about their goals, their aspirations, their targets for carbon, for water, for soil health. But it's really important to kind of live those and show those, demonstrate those targets, and put them out publicly. So we've certainly done that recently ourselves. That's tremendously helpful because it helps hold you to account, but also helps signal your values. You know, there was an interesting conversation in the previous session around how do you get consumers to understand what you're talking about? And how do you get the people who are making the buying decisions at that wine store or in that supermarket, you know, let you know your values and that they're aligned with theirs? Well, targets are a fantastic way to do that. They help, you know, tell people what's most important to you and why and how you're going to do it. So it helps kind of muster resources, it helps get things aligned, and it helps put the effort where it's needed because there are always too many things to do. So there's a few thoughts. I think public numbers are really important as well. Not everyone is forced to put out public numbers. Sustainability reports like Jack's and family have been doing and are incredibly important as well. They help kind of show that not everything is perfect and that it's a journey and that you're getting better and better. But if you're not talking about it, then how is anyone supposed to judge how you really are doing? I think it helps keeps everything both honest, but also it helps keep the value in the terms of sustainable, regenerative, or whatever you're doing to show that there is there behind those things. And then final thought is that as a publicly traded company, our investors are watching us very closely. They really want to make sure that we are going to be around for the long term and that as we continue to make fantastic wine, you know, that the investment is safe. So we have every interest to make sure that we're looking at the climate from a risk perspective and from a adaptation perspective, like what can we do to get ahead of this and what can we do? What things are coming down to the pipe towards us that we need to take care of? So weighing that into a climate strategy is incredibly important. It's not just about what you can do, but it's also what, you know, the world's a big place, what the world is going to do to you and how you're going to be make sure that you're using the softest chemistry, or you're being as efficient as you can with water, or you're making sure that your footprint in the community is as small as possible. They're all really important elements.
Thank you. So what you're saying is that what we call it matters less than the performance data we can report on. And that's very interesting because, you know, the other areas of business I work in, all the big companies have been rushing towards creating net zero targets and science-based targets around that. And then suddenly nature positive has arisen as the new thing you should aim for because it's more encompassing and allows for that biodiversity crisis to be tackled. And that's very confusing for companies. But ultimately, perhaps as you say, it's about the data you report and your performance, no matter what you call it at the front end. So on that point, what are the metrics that matter to your stakeholders? Because as everyone knows, climate change gets very complicated and technical very quickly. So what are the metrics that that matter?
Well, the ones that rose right to the top are the ones that we've recently announced targets for. But first of all, it was around reducing our scope 1 and 2 footprint as quickly as possible. So we have goals to be 100% renewable electricity globally by 2024. Which is maybe not world beating, but certainly extremely aggressive, especially for a company as large as Treasury. We put targets out to look at our water footprint and understand what we need to do there to make sure that we're acting within our watershed in a sustainable fashion. And water, unlike carbon, is a very different beast. Obviously, you know, carbon is sort of the common good or evil. My carbon I put out is everyone else's problem to deal with. But that's not the case with water. It's a very community-focused and specific commodity. And so you need to be tremendously careful, and a one-size-fits-all approach for water is not going to do it. So we made a commitment to study that and fine-tune that across our different global footprints. And then also packaging and waste. They are incredibly important. You don't have to go far to see that the footprint of a winery is not really about the wine they make or the tractors they drive in the vineyard, but much more to do about the packaging that they put it in, the transportation of that wine around the world. So, that gets to what Jess was talking about. That's often sort of a little bit more out of your control, even for a relatively large wine company. We have some buying power, but it's a collaboration, and the wine industry as a whole that's going to shift the deal on the footprint of glass bottles or what alternative packaging or anything else would look like. But we know in the short term that there's some important goals around recyclability and reusability and compostability. So we put goals out around that. And with all of these things, I think they'll evolve over time. I don't think anyone on this call has put out targets that have been the same for the last 10 years. I hope not. You know, the ambition keeps changing, and what we know about what we need to do keeps changing. So we expect that to happen as well. But those are our first three off the rank. So it's around packaging, it's around water, and it's around carbon.
Thank you. Well, it's a moving target, as you said. I listened to a podcast with the head of Greenpeace recently, who was saying, he was far more concerned about the biodiversity crisis than the climate crisis, in the sense that it's happening now and happening faster. Of course, it's hard to separate all things out. Julian, I'm interested to hear your views on all this and what should be captured under a climate strategy. You know, is it just GHGs, or will we be going broader at some point? Julian?
Sure. And I think first and foremost, I just want to acknowledge how much amazing information has already been shared on this panel. You guys are all incredible experts and incredibly passionate about really leading the industry forward. And I just think that we all have so much to learn from each other and from each other's research and from each other's work. And we talked a lot. One of my favorite phrases from graduate school was the concept of opening the kimono, which is a very scary term, particularly in the private sector. It's all about radical transparency and kind of, sharing your processes, sharing your challenges, sharing your advances, and really kind of doing it in the sense and the spirit of radical collaboration to move forward. And I think that that this essentially represents that. And in the last 10 odd years at Jackson Family Wines, where we've really taken a very serious focus and formalized our sustainability program and our efforts of measurement management, we've invested so many internal resources in kind of starting to drive progress forward, reducing our water efficiency or increasing our water efficiency, reducing our greenhouse gas emissions intensity, measuring all of these things, moving towards zero waste. What we recognized in kind of 2017, 2018 is that we would be a lot stronger doing it in a collective effort. And, given what we're learning and what we're seeing with the science, particularly around climate and the urgency around climate, that was really the driving factor for us in wanting to establish IWCA. And we found in Familia Torres of Spain a real kindred spirit, in the sense that they had been investing a significant amount of their own internal resources towards a lot of the same challenges and a lot of the same issues that we've been facing over the years. And when we created IWCA, it was really with this vision of taking what we were learning and working to open source with our various different members from the wine community in general, and creating this kind of pre-competitive collaborative working group that was aimed at advancing the entire industry towards a decarbonized future. And I think, since we started in 2019, we now have 10 members representing 6 different countries, 4 different continents. So in addition to Jackson and Torres, we were joined very early on by the Symington family in Portugal, and VSPT in Chile, Silver Oak and Spotswood in California, Amina Ribera and Alma Caravejas in Spain, and also Yealand's Estate and Cullen Wines in New Zealand and Australia. So we have this global perspective where everybody essentially has committed to these net zero targets. We recently joined the United Nations Race to Zero campaign. So IWCA was recognized earlier this year as the first food and agriculture participant in this global initiative to really accelerate the transition to a net zero future by 2050 at the latest. And, you know, by virtue of that affiliation, you know, all IWCA members are ultimately participating in this effort. And, you know, what we've seen in the meetings that we've had, and we meet quarterly now, all members meet quarterly, which is really fun to try to coordinate a global Zoom meeting where, unfortunately, many of the Australians kind of end up with the short end of the stick and they have to meet very early, but we're working on kind of figuring out how we get our scheduling snafus figured out. But we start to learn from each other. One of the things that we compiled early on and we released earlier this year was a global study on some of the soil health measurements and activities that our various different members are doing. We at Jackson Family Wines have looked at a lot of different tools to measure the potential for soil carbon sequestration, given the adoption and the scaling of what I'll call as regenerative practices. So I think, you know, Jess and Diana really touched on them. It's reduced tillage, it's compost in the vineyards, it's cover crops, it's animal integration. It's all of these things that really kind of build up soil health. What we recognized early on is that a lot of this stuff was just based on models. At least a lot of the tools that everybody was using were really based on models, and that there is by and large, there hasn't been enough scientific, you know, actual empirical scientific research within viticulture on how these practices impact soil organic carbon. And that was one of the things that we wanted to start looking into, both, you know, for IWCA, for Jackson Family Wines, so we could understand how the models that we're using actually apply to what we can expect to see in viticulture in Mediterranean climates. And, you know, by coming together and learning and working with our various different members, we've seen what an appropriate range has looked like, at least in practice over the last few years. And it's just been a really interesting kind of, you know, piece of really understanding kind of this global issue. One of the other tools that we just released yesterday at the pre-conference workshop that was focused on really introducing the world to IWCA is a greenhouse gas emissions calculator tool. And it's something that, you know, Toby, to your point, you asked about kind of scope. And for us, it really, you know, we wanted to develop a tool that was easy to use that, you know, any winery really anywhere in the world could be able to input their data into this tool. And it conforms to kind of all the high-level protocols, the WRI GHG protocol, following the ISO 14064 standard for greenhouse gas emissions measurement and verification. And we wanted to be able to create a tool that essentially would allow any organization to be able to use that tool to calculate their emissions across scopes 1 through 3, so their direct and their indirect emissions. And we're really excited to be rolling this out. We're starting first with a US-based tool and then working to update those emissions factors for regions around the globe. And ultimately, I think that to Jess's point earlier, you can't manage what you don't measure. And when you look at the value chain of a wine company and you look at kind of the opportunities to see where your organizational impacts are, a good GHG emissions inventory is a great starting point. And, you know, from our experience, and we've been measuring our emissions at Jackson Family Wines now for since about 2008, what we've seen, and this is why we wanted to really develop this tool that was available for everybody, is we kind of start to see what our major impacts are. And then as more and more IWCA members start to use and create their own emissions inventories and use this tool, we get a more complete picture of what the emissions related hotspots are for the industry. And I mean, the two primary things, and they've already been discussed today, are transportation. I mean, that is by and large the largest emissions contributor for the industry, and then the second is packaging. And so that then gives us a sense of, well, where do we target our efforts and how can we then work collectively to really kind of, you know, manage to measure and work to kind of dial the needle back on climate in as, you know, as aggressive a way as possible so that we can really kind of make the most of this next decade to advance our decarbonization efforts in alignment with what the science is essentially requiring.
Thanks, Julian. So an outsider looking in might say, on the basis of your last statement, well, surely what you should do is set a maximum bottle weight requirement for IWCA members and then bring that down until you get to the lowest possible number. But is that too simplistic a suggestion?
I mean, it's an interesting suggestion. I think some retailers are starting to do that at certain price points, and it's been really interesting to speak with them about some of the reasons for why. I had a long conversation with a retailer who made a demand of that, a similar demand a few years ago. And I was just really fascinated. I said, oh my God, that's amazing. You're really focused on you know, driving emissions reductions, and you've made the connection between heavy glass bottles and climate change. And he said, yes, and one of the major issues that we actually saw associated with these heavy glass bottles is workforce injuries, back-related injuries, because people are picking up these heavy cases and moving them around. And as a result of this new policy they put into place, I think they saw on the job back-related injuries fell by 80%. So, you know, recognizing what's driving these various different decisions is really important. And you know, I think as we start to think about what we can do as an industry, with a particular focus on glass packaging, you know, I think there are a couple of initial kind of easy wins come to mind is, yes, we can reduce the weight of our glass packaging. And there's this very fascinating conundrum where we as wine marketers have essentially told consumers for years and years and years that better wine comes in heavier glass packaging. And so now consumers actually believe that. And there's a lot of studies that have shown that. So we can absolutely, and we should absolutely, be working to reduce our bottle weights associated. And we need to be telling that story and talking to consumers directly about that opportunity. We can also work with our glass suppliers to increase recycled cullet. So, you know, more recycled cullet means a lower emissions footprint. And then, I mean, I think the big win on the glass side, and Miguel Torres, who spoke on the in the workshop yesterday with IWCA, touched on some of the efforts that the glass suppliers in Europe and globally are starting to focus on, is they need to really accelerate the shift to renewable energy. Right now, glass is so carbon intensive because you're melting sand at 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit using fossil fuel derived energy. So if we can transition to renewables, I think that that will hopefully accelerate, those efforts will accelerate. And there's some really good efforts happening in the glass world. But again, those conversations get pinpointed, and those conversations kind of, you know, increase in their urgency based on what we now recognize as the impacts associated with the various different activities.
Thank you, Julian. Yeah, very good point about low carbon or lower carbon footprint glass. I've seen some recent innovations discussed there. And, you know, given that we have to be realistic, other packaging options, as we discussed in our packaging workshop yesterday, all have unintended consequences and are all problematic in their own ways. Plus, you have the system and cultural change issues. So lower carbon glass certainly seems like a very good idea. And I noticed that System Bellagio, the Swedish monopoly, who are a founder member of the Sustainable Wine Roundtable, have announced, I think, an eco label they're bringing out. And I think to be part of it, the maximum bottle weight will be 420 grams. And that's something that's going into some of their procurement practices. But I'll leave it to them to say more on that. But that looks interesting. Julian, let me ask you something about winery emissions. Just to clarify, you said something really interesting yesterday in the workshop, which I didn't know, and maybe I should have done, which is that winery fermentation CO2 emissions don't count in scope 1, 2, and 3 because of their biogenic nature. And do you think there's a bit of confusion out there about that? And how should wine businesses look at tackling this? Because you know, I interviewed the Montrose CEO who's capturing carbon. We've spoken to Smith Lafitte owners, Daniel and Florence, so they're capturing carbon. They make it into potassium bicarbonate, I think. Yep. Then they don't really know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Because you can sell it for industrial use, but nobody really wants a small amount of it because it's kind of a very cheap thing. So yeah. Just talk us through the winery emissions bit, because it's complicated.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully we think we can use it as a soil amendment as well. A big picture. So biogenic emissions, which are essentially emissions that are created from, non-fossil fuel derived sources, are technically outside of scopes 1 through 3, according to the kind of the global international kind of GHG accounting protocols. That's how things are kind of currently assessed right now. That does not mean that those emissions are not real. It does not mean that those emissions do not exist. And it does not mean that those emissions do not contribute to global warming, climate change. So that's the piece on fermentation. I think fermentation emissions is kind of a great example of we in the wine industry have a really amazing opportunity because we have a highly concentrated source of CO2 emissions that are happening kind of within our own production facilities during harvest, where we could conceivably capture those emissions. On the flip side of that coin, carbon sequestration that happens in our vineyards just through the photosynthetic activity of our vines is also not recognized in these protocols. Neither at this point is carbon sequestration from cover cropping, from all of these other soil health enhancing practices that that Jess and Diana were talking about. So those aren't currently recognized. Now, with IWCA and with Jackson, we have committed to measuring those because we want to see what the potential is. We want to see what the feasibility is. We want to see what the opportunity looks like. We did a study that was based on a tool here in the United States called Comet Planner, which is a really great tool that was developed by the USDA, that kind of helps model the potential, carbon sequestration impacts of adopting various different practices that we've all described here. We did an initial study a few years back that looked at what we could theoretically sequester by adopting these various different practices. We estimated initially using the Comet tool that we could sequester about 100% or even over 100% of our annual emissions on an annual basis, scopes 1 through 3, by adopting these soil health building regenerative practices. And it was a really eye-opening kind of experience for me because, first of all, I went, oh my God, silver bullet, this is going to be great. We'll just, do this and then we're done. And as we did more and more research, and you've got a panel tomorrow with Dr. Christine Morgan from Soil Health Institute. And we went directly to her after we kind of did our own internal analysis. And we said, this is great using this tool, Comet, but it's actually not directly focused on viticulture and Mediterranean climates, which, as we know, are drier. And so the carbon values are potentially a lot less. And so we actually had Dr. Morgan and her team do a literature review and an assessment of what we could actually, what they thought we could sequester in, based on published research from other wine producers globally. And it came out to be about a fifth of what the Comet tool had modeled. And so I think kind of our key takeaway is, A, there needs to be more research allocated to what we can expect from these practices in various different cropping systems in various different climates. But also that, and I think directionally, Comet is a great tool because it tells you kind of what you need to do. So I think that there's a lot of really great tools that already exist, but there needs to be more research kind of specific to our industry.
So okay. I'd like to jump in here for just a minute because I think Julian brings up a very interesting point.
I can't see who this is. I'm going to come to questions shortly, but if you're not on the panel.
It's Jess. It's Jess on the panel.
Jess. Sorry, Jess. Was that you?
Yes.
I thought there was someone coming in that I couldn't see. My apologies. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to kind of piggyback on what some of what Julian was sharing, and also an interesting question that came in the chat from Pam Strayer. So I think that so much of this is industry specific, but also so much of it isn't, especially on the advocacy front. And really this idea of putting a price on carbon in general is something that needs to happen. And it's not unique to the viticulture industry. And these measurement problems are happening everywhere across all industries. I've seen them elsewhere. And they're whatever, like these are the questions everybody is talking about. How do we get a real, honest, accurate picture of what's happening? And how do we take responsibility for it and measure it over time? And so I think, the packaging piece is so important and is definitely something we're looking at. But we really believe there needs to be a price on carbon that happens at the federal level. And we advocate for that wherever we can. And in the meantime, in the absence of that, we've put essentially a carbon tax on ourselves. And what that looks like is measuring the entirety of our emissions and budgeting a certain amount of money per ton. And we know that the measurement is not perfect. We know that it's not necessary, that it's an estimation. It's always going to be an estimation. There's always going to be things maybe that are like overcounted for. For instance, we grow 100% organic grapes and we don't have an emission factor specific to organic versus conventional. And we know that it's less. We know it should be less, but we're overcounting because we just don't have that data yet. And so we're estimating essentially and then putting a certain amount of money per ton in order to sequester carbon. And to Pam Strayer's point in the chat, that's not just happening throughout our supply shed. We know that the carbon that we emit as a business in California has global effects. And so we need to take responsibility for that globally, and we need to do it in ways that matter. And so we support nature-based projects, really nature-positive projects, as was said earlier in the panel, in order to follow the leading science about where sequestration can be the most impactful. And so we look at land-based, nature-based, nature-positive projects instead of just purchasing offsets, say that, our landfill gas projects or wind projects, we're actively putting that carbon that we're emitting in equal measure back into the ground with our carbon tax.
Thanks, Jess. Sorry for interrupting. You'd fallen off my screen. I couldn't see you there. Thank you for that great point. There's some really interesting questions coming in on the theme of grape growers, and they're often a kind of slightly forgotten group in some senses. They probably see themselves more as farmers in some ways, and often neglected, perhaps lower margin. Justin Howard Sneed asked a great question about, are there some quick fixes that all grape growers around the world could adopt that could help in the sequestration of carbon and the improvement of soils? If so, what are they? And, why aren't we doing more on the grower side? Diana, let me come to you here as perhaps the smaller producer here. You, I'm sure, know a lot of growers, and I know the rest of the panel will have comments too, and I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I understood the question also to be, to what extent are they being impacted by these climate events? I mean, so what can they do? On the one hand, I think we have talked about it, really look after soil health. And for example, my family sells grapes. And we decided a long time ago on our 170 acres, we would never have more than 23 acres of planted grapes. And we have the rest is just forest. And it's only recently that we're going to start seeing some sort of subsidies for this, what is essentially a sacrifice, keeping wild land wild. So supporting diversity of your land holdings and supporting forest is one thing that you can do as a company as well. But then looking at soil life. And I think there's some other great questions which I'd like to address as well. The policy question I think is huge. For Napa, one of the most impactful things that we could do is start making affordable housing up valley. Thousands of people drive up and down Highway 29 every day to work in vineyards and restaurants and in hotels. And the housing is just so horrendously expensive. They don't have another alternative. So all of those emissions could be greatly reduced if they had affordable housing in Calistoga, St. Helena, Rutherford. I mean, those kinds of big moves are beyond any small grower. and it's going to take collective action. Another thing is, you know, one part of the puzzle of bottles is recycling. The recycling rates in the United States are absolutely barbaric. And that's government policy as well. And that's choices. Another thing that we haven't said is that we're running out of sand. We are going to face a glass shortage. And there will be some point where we're going to start mining in our own landfills to find glass to make more bottles. So I think policy is, you know, working collectively, working with government collectively to help support the work that we're already doing is just essential at this stage.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you, Jess. On the grower point specifically, is there anything you wanted to add there about ways of communicating, perhaps simple practices that can make sense to them, and given their mind and so on?
Yeah, I think it's really important that we work with our growers and that wherever possible, we have longer term contracts so that we can really support them in making meaningful change. We support our growers. We have had a program for a long time to support growers converting from conventional to organic and purchasing their grapes in that transition phase. And I think that we need to do the same thing in looking at regenerative growing. We need to really support them and share learnings. And that also is one of the interesting benefits of this industry that, you know, we're a California-based winery. We're growing grapes in a certain area of California, and we're purchasing grapes from that area and others in California, but close enough that we can, you know, get in the car and go, you know, obviously an electric car. Because as was mentioned in the last panel, we need to reduce our driving and our flying. We can get in a car and go talk to them, and we can bring them to our vineyard and show them on site what we're doing. And I think that proof of concept piece is really important, because for farmers making change, and people that work on vineyards are farmers essentially. And making change is scary because And I've been a farmer myself. And so I know that firsthand that making change is scary. And you need to see it working in action before you're ready and willing to do it. And so I think that's something that I really appreciate about the way that we're set up, is that we are farmers first. And second, we're wine farmers and wine producers, and we also purchase grapes. So we have that ability to demonstrate what's possible, to bring others in and encourage them through proof of concept to make changes. And I think we have to show that this is so much more than just, like, this has to be a really holistic approach and not just about the sum of its parts. And that's one point I really want to make, that I think it's so important to have a strategy. It's so important to have metrics and key targets and to have that quantified approach. And it's so important to realize that there's also something outside of that, that this is more than the sum of its parts, that there is a holistic approach. We're talking about a living system, and there's something unknowable and intangible in that that we also have to account for, that can't be put into numbers. And if we get, I think we have to be measuring carbon, and we also have to be measuring biodiversity and understanding our impact on nature, on the natural world. And by that, I mean outside of our vineyards, but also the way that it goes all throughout the planet from there, because the carbon that we emit in California has impacts on all parts of the world. And so I think we have to look at that piece too.
Thank you. Will, I wondered if you had any comment on the grower side of things. In other areas of agriculture, we've worked with the Global Farmer Network, which is a really interesting peer-to-peer learning group of farmers from Iowa to Indonesia, who are a part of a virtual and physical network, who meet and discuss their commonalities. It's really interesting to see how that conversation is evolving. And I wondered what your views were on this, because it seems like a very important part of the puzzle.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at your supply chain both upstream and downstream. So you got to have conversations with people making your bottles as well as people growing the fruit. In terms of simple things that can make a big difference quickly, we discovered through, you know, we have large sections of the Napa River we've restored over several miles. When you do the same comet model that Julian was talking about earlier, you realize quite how much looking after riparian areas, whether that's floodplains in Australia or whether that's up and down the banks of the Napa River. That sequesters an enormous amount of carbon, but it also has huge other benefits. So engaging growers and showing them how how we did it, how we didn't actually give up that much land, how we prevented flooding, how we actually saved a whole bunch of headaches with not having to drag debris out of our vineyards and reducing our pests disease, that's got nothing to do with carbon, but it has this enormous carbon side benefit. So whenever you're telling stories or opening up your properties or showing people what success looks like, you can bring these different factors together. We host, for instance, in our Gamble Ranch in Oakville in Napa, the North Coast Soil Hub, where we do exactly what the panel's already been talking about. We have a demonstration site for no-till and cover cropping, and we have another site coming up for biochar implementation. And the intention is just to bring any grower or anyone who wants to see the North Coast Soil Hub, along with the Napa RCD and other folks, to see those demonstration sites. I couldn't agree more with the panel about, it's important to show working models of how things can go to take away some of that kind of, it's not always even fear. It's just like, is it worthwhile? Does it really work in the real world? Is it practical enough to do, or is it just going to get in my way? So that's really important. And then there's the other important thing is getting people on that first ladder, right? So lowering barriers to entry for getting into sustainable farming schemes. If you can support your growers to get on board by doing training for them or covering the cost of certification or whatever the different steps are, or even just being an advocate on those certifying bodies to say, let's get rid of the stuff that doesn't really work or is just paperwork and get back to allowing them to make a difference and back to farming. All of those things ring really true with growers. So, all of us are both growers and wineries at the same time. So we see it from both perspectives. It's not an us and the them barrier. There's a lot to be shared from how these things can come together.
Thanks very much. Well, that seems like a good place to end. We're going to take a quick break and come back at 5 past the hour. But please join me in virtually giving a round of applause for Diana, for Julian, for Jess and Will. Thank you all very much for your insights. That was really fascinating. I learned a huge amount. I hope the audience did too. Some great questions in the chat and great conversations. We'll try and save those for distribution afterwards in some way. We'll take that for 10 minutes or so, about 8 minutes now, and we'll see you back here. We're going to stay on this link, but just go on mute with video off for about 5 or 6 minutes for a quick break. And thanks again to the panel and look forward to the next one. Thank you.